Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Marcellaro. And this week, my guest is the founder of Red Sweater Software, Daniel Jalkut. Daniel, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
You are the founder of Red Sweater Software, most famous, I think, from Mars Edit. You're also a former Apple employee from, I think, about 1995 to 2002. Is that right?
That's right.
And so I wanted to ask you, I want to go back in time, and as Background Mode does, and talk to you about how all this happened. You have a bachelor's degree in computer and information science from the University of California at Santa Cruz. And so what were you thinking about in those days, before, even before Apple? I think you were into music, and then there was this, maybe a transition to computer science.
Oh, I think I was just into music as a kind of, you know, teenage interest, or just, you know, I've always been into music, but the computer science thing is something that I sort of inherited from my dad, who was a compiler engineer. So the way I ended up actually studying computer science was kind of, it was kind of quote unquote taking the easy way out, because I really didn't know what I wanted to do in school. I kind of didn't want to do school, but I felt like I should. And so at UC Santa Cruz, I decided to pursue the computer science realm, just mainly because it seemed like it was coming pretty easily to me. I think I knew that I kind of had a knack for it and had been exposed to so much computer stuff over the course of my childhood.
Were there computers at home in your life that kind of wound you up?
Oh yeah. I had computers, in my life starting as early as I think about 1982 with a Timex Sinclair.
Oh, I remember that. The little black brick or so. Yeah. That was an amazing little computer.
Yeah, so folks, you know, especially younger listeners probably won't believe that you could buy this little, you know, touch pressure pad keyboard device, and you would plug it into your television set and, you know, save and load files to a tape recorder. But that's what first got me interested in computers, and I moved on through, you know, thanks to my dad being both a programmer and a kind of tech kind of gizmo fan. So we had, you know, just off the top of my head, I guess we went through Commodore 64, K-Pro, Amiga.
Memories.
We went K-Pro. Through. And then, you know, it's funny, I'm obviously so entrenched in the Mac world now, but I didn't have a Mac until Mac was probably my sixth or seventh computer. I had gone through all these other computers, Amiga. I ended up getting a Sun workstation because I went through a Unix phase. I bought an old, like, refrigerator sized Silicon Graphics indie computer.
Oh, I had an indie years ago on my desk. That was a cool computer.
You don't need to pay a heating bill if you have one of those. but anyway, yeah, I ended up actually getting a Mac. My first Mac I got as a college student, and sort of as I was starting to pursue computer science stuff in college, I got a Mac and I started teaching myself to program it. And I hadn't really, even though I was pretty...
In the early days of the Mac, what did that mean? Did that mean the development system that Apple provided in Pascal, or was it C?
It was sort of at the crossover period when I was picking it up. I was about 1994, I guess.
Oh, by then Pascal was dead.
Yeah, it was a sort of a funny transition period, because it was really going away in favor of C, but all the documentation was still in Pascal. Mm-hmm. And by the time I ended up in my first programming job at Apple in 96, that it was funny because most people in the developer community were not using Pascal, but a lot of Apple's internal stuff was still written in Pascal. So I kind of had like a lot of experience from my early days at Apple going through with Pascal, assembly language, and C, among other things.
I wanted to go back and ask you, how did you get that job right out of your undergraduate days with Apple. Did you intern or how did you manage that?
Yeah, my foot in the door was actually through contract agency as a young guy, 18 years old. I had friends, you know, this is one of the privileges of growing up in the Bay Area in California. I had friends who worked at Apple, both as full-time employees, and some of them worked as contract employees. And as I said, I wasn't really a programmer yet. I didn't have much experience. So I ended up going to one of the contract agencies in the San Jose area. And I said, I want to work at Apple. And what can you do for me? And they ended up finding me a quality assurance job on a contract. And it was just perfect because it was in the System 7 engineering team. So I ended up being in a perfect position to learn more about programming and really have a bunch of mentors there who would, I made it very clear I'm interested in programming and want to get better at this. And so some of the great, great old timer, you know, software developers at Apple kind of gave me these crazy challenges for things to do. And
really quality assurance can sometimes be an important stepping stone because it sounds boring and sometimes it feels boring. But the facility with which you find bugs and the demeanor with you present them and the way you work with the team can be very instrumental in you moving up, I think.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And it's something that a lot of programmers lack a skill in quality assurance, you know, quality, that kind of testing mentality that I think a lot of programmers would write better code if they had some experience in that field.
Absolutely. So let me ask you about the Mac OS 7 days. I've heard a rumor long ago. I've always wanted to ask somebody about this and you're the perfect person. I had heard a rumor years ago that the Mac OS software, Mac OS 7 was in a state of disarray. It wasn't well stored or backed up or managed and existed on lots of different machines. That it was kind of a difficult thing to work with because it was not professionally backed up and revision managed and so on, as opposed to Mac OS nowadays. Was that true?
You know, I don't have specific experience with System 7 being poorly managed in that way. By the time I came along, I was working on System 7.5 and beyond. But I can say that I worked on some other projects at Apple that were comically poorly managed as far as the source control management goes. Mm-hmm. So I can easily believe, based on some experience with other projects, that there was a similar problem in the System 7 management at one point. I mean, I inherited a project at one point that they literally dropped the CD-ROMs on my desk and said, this is the project. And I thought, oh, this must be a copy of the project from wherever. No, these are like the master CD-ROMs. So that kind of thing. They've obviously gotten really good at that over the years. They've gotten, you know, in other words, I doubt that anything like that happens anymore at Apple. But it was a pretty, one of the charming things about Apple, I think, historically, is they've been kind of a by the seat of their pants company in many respects. And some of that meant, you know, there's charmingly simple solutions to some of these problems.
Then you transitioned into the Mac OS 10 days, which was what, about 1998 or so?
About 99, I think, was when I moved over there. I moved over while it was, I think, the developer preview. So it was before 10.0 had shipped, but people had already been working on it for a bit. And the transition was clear enough that to me and to many other people in the Mac OS 9, you know, department, it looked like, hey, if we want to be involved with the long-term stuff going on, kind of became clear to us that Mac OS 9 was not going to be it. So
did you guys get really excited about Mac OS 9 having a Unix? I mean, sorry, Mac OS 10, because it was Unix and it had preemptive multitasking, protected memory. I mean, must have been a real jazzy time to think, wow, we're moving into the future.
Yeah, well, that kind of stuff was a great litmus test for how excited people were about some of those things. Sort of predicted whether they would end up staying at Apple or or not, because some folks, quite to the contrary, I think were skeptical about all that stuff and kind of just wanted to keep things the way they were. And, you know, people had a whole spectrum of perspectives about macOS 9 and whether it was, you know, sorely in need of some of those Unix-like things or whether it was going to be destroyed or, you know, ruined by that.
I lived through that time myself. I was a Lockheed Martin in 97 when Lockheed Martin had more or less had it with the fact that you didn't have a modern microkernel. There was no authentication, login logs. Windows NT was coming along at that point. It checked every box for the corporation. And it's a good thing that Apple moved on because the old Mac OS 7.8.9 was not cutting it in the corporate place. Windows NT was eating Apple's lunch, as I recall.
Yeah, I believe it. And it's, you know, it's funny. I was biased towards really appreciating the Mac OS 10 Unix underpinnings because, as I mentioned, you know, I had that Unix background, partly from my college days, partly from, you know, tinkering with my son workstation. And it's funny, I came to the Mac and kind of gave up all my Unix stuff because I liked the Mac so much. And when the opportunity came to, you know, get the best of both worlds, of course, I in particular was really excited about it.
What were you doing on Mac OS 10? I saw in your bio that you were involved with Carbon. Is that right?
Yeah, I worked on the team called Core Services, which is it's not limited to Carbon, but it's the stuff I worked on was mostly called Carbon Core, and it was basically the lower level stuff from the old Mac OS 9 days ported over to run on Mac OS 10. So in particular, the stuff I was doing was really adapting the old interfaces that people programmed to for Mac OS 9 and making it so that, for example, if you were a Carbon developer back in those days, it was very useful that Apple provided these libraries that you could just kind of recompile against and then fix a few things. And then your old app from Mac OS 9 would build and run.
I remember that, but you had to go through, you had to run a program to check where you didn't have reentrant code, right? And it was a special name for that scanner that went through your code and saw if it was reentrant and ready for Unix.
Yeah, there was a script that I think DTS provided that would flag most of the problematic APIs, and it was it wasn't necessarily even just whether it was reentrant, but there were things that Apple took the opportunity at that point to say, "Hey, this is a little bit too clunky. We're going to get rid of this and replace it with something new." So there were a bunch of things that you had to change. So for example, like, at that time, I remember we were working with a bunch of the big software teams like Microsoft and Adobe, making sure that they could get converted over. And so the stuff we worked on in that team was very, very connected to kind of helping existing Mac developers embrace Mac OS X.
Microsoft dragged their feet for a long time on Carbon, as I recall. They weren't exactly quick to jump over to Cocoa. Is that right?
You know, I think a lot of the big names were because their source bases were just so big. And I think I don't remember specifically Microsoft, but I would not be surprised. I mean, it's one of those things where if you think about the competitive nature of the software world and Apple, if Apple's saying, "Hey, either you can completely re-architect your whole software suite, or you can just keep using this compatibility layer, Carbon in this case," most companies probably would just, you know, choose to keep on cruising along.
Yeah. Well, it's almost time for a break. When we come back, I want to ask you about leaving Apple and starting Red Sweater Software and the big move from California. But first, we have to take a break, okay?
Sounds good.
Folks, stay with us. We'll be back in 60 seconds after this short commercial message.
Hello there, all you fabulous background mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage where we have a section called Support TMO. or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
Thanks, Kelly. I'm chatting with Red Sweater Software founder Daniel Jalkut. Daniel, so there came a time then when you left Apple. Was founding a software company on your mind at the time? Was that something you were just ready to do at that moment?
No, it was really far from on my mind. I think I've always had a entrepreneurial attitude, but and as it happens, I had founded Red Sweater Software a few years before I left Apple, but it was kind of just a little novelty. You know, I wanted to make some shareware and I wanted to have an outlet for my hobby programming projects. So I had Red Sweater technically around, but I wasn't working on it full time, and it was by no means meant to be sort of a career.
You weren't allowed to sell it at the time. It was sort of like carbon copy cloner, right? You can just mess with it, but you can't go commercial when you're working for Apple, right?
You know, at that time, the Apple wasn't that uptight about that kind of thing. Or at least the word hadn't gotten out that they were uptight about it.
Okay.
I know a lot of people back then who were working on other stuff. It's a little tricky because Apple has its policies and they sort of maybe don't mesh entirely with what the policies of the state law of California are. So I think there over the years has been a lot of speculation about how much Apple can really limit that. But a lot of people who work at Apple, you know, do respect the requests of the company. And I think if anybody at Apple had asked me not to do this stuff on the side, I probably would have stopped. But it just didn't seem to be much of an issue for most people back then as it is today. Today, definitely, it's a, you know, pretty widely understood that if you're going to work on if you're going to work for Apple, then they don't want you doing your own thing on the side.
Right. So what did finally lead to you leaving Apple and founding, not founding, but going commercial with Red Sweater? And how did the name come about?
Oh, the name is, I mean, it couldn't be simpler. I was looking for a name for my software company, and I was literally wearing a red sweater.
Really?
Yeah. Yes. And, the funny thing is that I, it turns out, have only ever owned that one red sweater, and I haven't had it. I threw it out years and years ago. I probably threw it out even before I left Apple. And
it's not in some glass case somewhere. No, it's too bad.
I didn't know there would be a reason to remember it. But yeah, so I picked that name because I was wearing the sweater, and I think I just liked the fact that it was kind of abstract and cute, and it didn't have to mean much at the time. I think so. I left Apple in 2002. Funnily enough, it's so funny to think about it 15 years later as being this way. But I remember having this attitude. I was working on, I think, macOS 10.2.
Is that Jaguar?
That sounds about right, yep. And it was about to ship. So I kind of felt like my work was done. And I was looking down at the roadmap for where macOS 10 was going, and I mean, I was so wrong about it.
From Jaguar to Snow Leopard, we had this quintessential Unix, BSD Unix operating system with a beautiful GUI. And then things kind of changed after Snow Leopard.
Yeah, well, I mean, things have been constantly changing. I just to wrap up that thought, I kind of, one of the reasons I left was I kind of felt like, well, this work is done. Let's move on to something else. But clearly, I mean, many of my old friends at Apple and new people who've joined since have, I mean, I had no clue about iOS coming down, you know, the line. So there was, turns out if I would have stayed at Apple, there would have been plenty of interesting things to work on, but it just sort of happened to mesh with my curiosity about what, you know, what might be out there for me outside of Apple. And, you know, you mentioned earlier, I had this music interest. It was actually, I used my music interest as a sort of, catalyst to leave Apple, because I decided to give myself a goal to obtain a music degree. So I went back to school, and that's what motivated me to leave Apple. So there wasn't any like ambition to make a red sweater a company or anything like that, but it was just this. I actually sort of envisioned myself going back to Apple after getting this music degree, and it just sort of ended up not happening.
Interesting. So just jumping ahead a little bit, was Mars Edit something that had been a bee in your bonnet for a while, or did you have to kind of research the market and figure out what there was to do?
So Mars Edit, it's worth, very much worth clarifying, Mars Edit was not my invention. So Mars Edit came from an offshoot of Net Newswire by Brent Simmons. So he was the original developer of Mars Edit, and I think he started it in about, boy, I'm gonna say like 2004 or something, and might have even been earlier. It's funny, but he was working on it for a couple years, and I ended up acquiring it in 2007. So I've been working on Mars Edit for 10 years now. So I've been working on it much longer than he did, but he still definitely deserves all the credit for thinking of the idea and getting the app going.
Did he sell it to you, or did he just donate it?
No, it's funny. He actually sold his whole company at the time to a company called NewsGator. And so they bought his company, I think, primarily for Net Newswire. And so at that time, sort of came to realize they didn't really have any interest in Mars Edit. So he was sort of a friend of mine. I'd met him through the developer community and conferences and stuff. So he got in touch with me and he said, "Do you want to, you know, my company wants to sell this and I think you should buy it." And so it was a pretty good, you know, it was the relationship was softened by me knowing him and the company kind of being eager to get it sold. And so I ended up going for it and just sort of took it on. I think it was version 1.1 or something at the time. And now I'm on the verge, finally, hopefully, of releasing 4.0. So we've come a long way. It's been 10 years. But
what's new in 4.0?
4.0, boy, there's a bunch of new stuff, but a lot of it is aimed at sort of just trying to keep up with the changing blogging world. So as you no doubt know, WordPress in particular is constantly changing. So there's a lot of things to update for that. There's a lot of things that have been improved in the APIs that Mars Edit connects to. So there's things that weren't possible before that I can do much better now. Like, for example, historically, you couldn't download all the posts from your blog if you wanted to sort of sync up with it. And that was based on limitations in the API, the connection that Mars Edit talks to the like WordPress server with. And they've made changes to that so that I can now efficiently download all the posts. So that's going to be something that's going to make the app a lot more interesting to people. You know, I don't really have my feature list right in here in front of me, so I don't have a lot of specific things to say. But if folks are interested, they should Google for Mars Edit 4 beta, because I posted a blog post on my blog. Yeah. And I list the main high level things there, and I would say it's going to be a good opportunity for folks who have been using and love Mars Edit and have just been satisfied with it over years. I think they're going to be they're going to be, you know, delighted to see some of the new things. And then I think for many folks, I'm hoping that many folks who found something here or there that just didn't quite work for them with it, that with this update, they'll find that it fits their workflow better.
Tell me about your pricing philosophy and your customers. $40 is an interesting price in the Mac App Store, you know, in this day when people sort of get a little irritated with software that costs more than $10. You've made a good living selling a $40 piece of software because people need it to be productive. But did you start with that price right along at the beginning? And tell me if you're thinking about what you think about subscription pricing, and are you mulling that over?
Yeah, it's the app Marzetta has never been. I think when I acquired it, it was selling for $25 maybe. And I think when I acquired it, I think I immediately raised the price after the first update I did. After the
bold move.
I raised it to I think it was $25. I raised it to $30. It's been kind of interesting trying to figure out, like you said, I think a lot of people are less sensitive to the price because they can sense that it's really working. You know, it's useful to them. It's saving them time. It's especially for folks who are making any money off of their blogs, they can easily justify it. It's been a little challenging to figure out what the mentality is for Marzetta customers, because while it's attractive to many, like, professional bloggers, it's also attractive to really new and like inexperienced bloggers, because it takes, you know, some of the complexity of going and logging into a website and writing on a browser. It kind of takes that complexity away. So I kind of am serving a very pro market and a very kind of just simplified market. And I can see how the price has to kind of be a balance. Like, you know, if it was a fully pro product, the only audience was only professionals, I'd probably have to charge $100 for it or something to, you know, make up for the proportionally lower number of sales. I guess my attitude, and getting back to your original question, my attitude is increasingly just sort of recognizing how much money it costs to make and maintain a great app. And I think a lot of developers are like me, that we're sort of undervaluing what we sell. And I think you rightly point out that like $40 to a lot of people is a lot of money for an app. But I think what's interesting is it's still, I'm still not convinced actually that that's the right price. And I think that a lot of people out there, you see these apps come and go, and some, I think you'd find that, often the apps that come and go the most are the ones where they try to charge something like $10 for an app that, frankly, can't be sustained on that. So, you know, my attitude is basically try to charge the amount that can actually sustain it and keep me and my family and, you know, in business. And when that succeeds, it means the app actually sticks around for 10, 15 years.
Yeah, you've been doing great. Thoughts on subscriptions?
Oh, subscriptions. Yeah, my attitude about subscriptions is I think ideally most software would be available either as a subscription or as a sort of one-time payment. And I can easily see the rationale for both. And I can, you know, so I can see as a customer, I can easily see not wanting to sort of have to keep paying in perpetuity for something.
Yeah, that's the objection a lot of people have.
Right. I mean, and it's one of those things, we can't get too blinded by the sort of like, as developers, we can have knowledge of all the real costs. And so we can say, well, we need to be paid for ongoing maintenance and da-di-da-di-da, but customers don't care about the rationale for that. And as a customer myself of other software packages, I also don't want to pay, you know, $10 a month for something.
You especially almost need an app to keep track of all your subscriptions and when they're due and how much it all comes to.
Right. Right.
Maybe there's a project there.
So I think there's a lot to be said for, I mean, when software is being developed and sold on like the traditional upgrade pricing, model. It really is sort of a subscription. It's just put into terms that a lot of customers have an easier time dealing with. So, you know, if I charge $40 and I update the app once every 2 years, well, people are paying me $20 a year if they keep updating the app, but it feels less like a, it feels less like a sort of baggage.
You can do it when you're ready instead of feeling like it's going to quit on you unless you pay up.
That's right. Yeah. So I think I, you know, on the other hand, a lot of people really appreciate, I think, the ability to just kind of dip into using an app. And if they aren't, you know, they're not going to use it for a few months, hey, just stop paying the subscription price. You know, if I were, let's say if I were a pro photographer who only worked in the summer, let's say I'm a school teacher in the year and a pro photographer in the summer, I think I'd be pretty excited about being able to pay a monthly fee for Photoshop just in the summer months, you know. Sure. There's a lot of, there's also a lot of merit, I think, in being able to just sample things, you know, especially these days we're moving away with the app stores are moving us away from this paid upgrade model. So, and often you don't even have an option for a free trial. So, you know, if it comes down to, you know, paying $3 for a month of an app to find out whether you like it, that's something most people, I think, could justify. The subscriptions really work well for that.
Interesting perspectives. Well, we're not quite out of time, but we're starting to get there. And I wanted to make sure that we talked about something that you and I talked about before the show, and that was your thoughts on Apple's September 12th phone event.
Yeah.
So what'd you think?
You know, there's this kind of, people have the funny reaction to Apple events where they make jokes about, like, well, there goes my wallet, or, you know, Apple take all my money. And I often don't feel that way, but this particular event really got me in the wallet, I guess I should say, because I'm a satisfied Apple Watch user, but I have one of those very first edition ones, and it's been bashed up a bit. I'm really been like waiting for a new Apple Watch so I could buy a new one. So kind of like on the hook for that. My Apple TV I also love, and the Apple TV remote stopped working. So of course, naturally I could go buy a new remote, but it's just a great excuse to buy a new Apple TV instead. And
there's the HomePod, and there's the iPhone X.
Right. Well, the HomePod, I guess, hasn't even, you know, we don't have the privilege yet of devoting our money to that. But yeah. But the iPhone X, I think I'm going to end up justifying going for. And so it's going to be an expensive fall.
It is.
Just means I have to really make sure I get some of those $40 software sales going.
Speaking of expensive fall, can I ask you what Mac you used for your development?
Yeah, I've been using a MacBook Pro, 15-inch MacBook Pro, for the past several years. I've gone through a few iterations of the same basic, like, you know, relatively top of the line MacBook Pro, 15-inch. So I have the current one. I have is the Touch Bar. Late 2016, I think they call it.
Yep.
And it's not my favorite MacBook Pro of all time, but it's, you know, it's a perfectly fine computer.
How's it going with dealing with those four USB-C ports? Are you using a Thunderbolt dock, or are you just using dongles?
I just got one of those USB to, you know, old style USB adapters. Mm-hmm. And I'm most like looking at my computer right here. I have my old USB hub, and then I've got that going into my MacBook Pro through one of those adapters. And that has worked pretty well for me so far, because I guess because I have all these old USB standard, you know, I guess it's USB A. And so I am a little frustrated by it sometimes, but, it really, I have to say, I'm charmed by USB-C. I think it's going to be really great when everything is using some variation on it. And I love being able to plug my power into either side of the MacBook Pro. And it just feels, you know, I thought I would be more mournful about the loss of the MagSafe adapter. But
well, there's several solutions I've seen on the market where you plug a little dongle in and then you have an external MagSafe connected to the USB-C.
Right. And I guess the fact that I haven't bought one of those shows you how much it's really bothered me.
What do you think of the touch bar? Are you going to develop for it, or have you already?
I'm certainly going to develop for it to some extent. I haven't done much with it yet. From a developer point of view, I think it's important to support those things just in, you know, you want your software to show off the you know, latest and greatest stuff that Apple has to offer. From a user point of view, I haven't found much use for it yet. And it's, I've fallen into the camp where probably, when it comes down to it, it's probably more of a drag for me to have it than a joy. And it's just the classic things. Like, it's easy to accidentally knock it. You don't have the tactile experience of, you know, so many of us using Macs for years. We know exactly where to go for the brightness knob or the volume knob. And frankly, having that be a sort of interactive experience with a screen doesn't add much to me, for me, in most use cases. But I'm still holding out hope that other developers and maybe Apple will continue to develop for it in a way that makes me really appreciate having it.
Very good. Very good. Well, we are about out of time now. I wanted to ask you if you have any closing thoughts, anything we didn't cover, or any exciting future stuff you're thinking of that you can tell us about. Don't want to pry.
Yeah, not really. The thing is, I've been so fixated. I didn't really mention this, but it's one of the bits of trivia about Mars Edit 4 is it's unfortunately been 7 years since Mars Edit 3 came out. So I have been sort of working under the increasing weight of wishing this project was done and I had released it. So I haven't indulged much in the way of like looking forward to other projects or, maybe new apps or anything like that. I'm just kind of a one trick pony for a while as I, you know, move on towards finishing this release up. So I'll be happy to talk to you again when I'm done with this and I have some more ideas.
Well, I'll be looking forward to Mars Edit 4. I want to thank you so much for joining me and chatting about all these things. Boy, that time went fast, didn't it?
It sure did. Thanks for inviting me on. It's been an honor.
You're very welcome. Tell the listeners how to contact you.
Oh, sure. The best way if you're on Twitter is my Twitter ID, and it's Daniel Punkass. Hopefully that's not too provocative for your show, but I'm also my company site is red-sweater.com, and that's basically it. Those are the two best ways to sort of ping me if you want to get in touch about my company or anything else. So
okay, great. So listeners, thanks for joining us with Daniel Jalkut, and we'll see you next week on the Mac Observer's Background Mode.